From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Zen Hospice Project co-founder and Buddhist teacher Frank Ostasevsky has spent over 3 decades working with the dying. But it wasn't until he had his own close brush with death after a heart attack and quadruple bypass that he says he stopped taking life for granted.
I live with a sense of urgency, and by that I don't mean panic. I mean that I want to live fully into my life. I don't want to miss a moment.
Coming up, Frank Ostasevsky joins us to talk about his new book, The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. Join us after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, death is inevitable. Many of us choose not to think about our own mortality or that of our loved ones, and this is not true for Frank Ostasevsky. He's the co-founder of San Francisco's Zen Hospice Project, and he's accompanied more than 1,000 people through the intimate process of dying. From a bedside vantage point, he has listened to countless regrets and revelations, lessons that he passes on in his new book, The Five Invitations. A longtime Buddhist teacher, Frank Ostasevsky now directs the Metta Institute, which he founded back in 2004. It provides education on spirituality in dying, and he joins us for this forum hour to talk about what the dying process can teach us about living fuller lives. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Michael. Just a delight to be with you. I'm sitting here with the legendary Michael Krasny. You know, I feel very honored. It's like being with a rock star.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say, but there'll be people who say he's only a legend in his own mind, like Clint Eastwood said. We're talking about a difficult subject here, but you have been on the precipice with so many people and have really guided and aided and helped so many people. I just want to take my hats off to you. I mean, what I do is sit behind a microphone. But what you do is something, and this is not quid pro quo or mutual admiration or anything like that, but I want to just talk about how you do it, because and then we can get into the whole idea of living life more fully. There's a selflessness, it seems to me, in hospice work, in the kind of work you've done. It goes all the way back to the AIDS plague and epidemic and so forth. And most of us just don't have the temperament for it. I mean, we may be loving and we may be kind and merciful and have compassion and everything, but to sit with people and to nurture them as their final curtain is coming down seems to me to be kind of one of the pinnacles of a kind of selflessness. So very simple question. How do you do it and keep doing it? And where do you draw from to do it?
Well, first of all, Michael, I think you've been a great supporter of the Zen Hospice over the years, and I want to thank you for that. I think that, for me, service has always been a thread that went through my whole life, compassionate action. And for me, service is mutually beneficial. You know, when I'm working with someone who's dying, I'm also taking care of myself. I'm learning there. I'm nurturing myself as I care for others. So for me, that's the real mark of true service. I'm not the good guy coming in on a white horse. I'm learning. I'm growing in the course of this activity. And that's part of what keeps me balanced and allows me to keep doing the work. People show me and expose to me their most vulnerable parts of their lives. And for me, this is a great gift. This is a tremendous kindness that they're offering me. And
you feel rewarded as well, I presume.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I feel rewarded. And I feel like I've been given entrance into a very special time with them, an intimate time, sometimes a time that we don't even ever get to share with our own family and friends.
I'd like you to do this for us, if you could. Just read the first couple of short paragraphs in your book, because it really stakes out what the book is about and what a lot of your work has been about.
Sure. So this is from the introduction, and it reads, "Life and death are a package deal. You can't pull them apart." You know, in Japanese Zen, there's a term, shoji, which translates as birth, death. And there's no separation between life and death other than a small hyphen, a thin line that connects the two. We cannot be truly alive without maintaining an awareness of death. Death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us, in the marrow of every passing moment. She is the secret teacher, hiding in plain sight. She helps us to discover what matters most. And the good news is, we don't have to wait until the end of our lives to realize the wisdom that death has to teach. In fact, to imagine that at the time of our dying, we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is a ridiculous gamble. So this book is an invitation, five invitations actually, to sit down with death, to have a cup of tea with her, to let her guide you toward living a more meaningful and loving life.
Why death is a she?
Well, partly, it's such a soulful experience, right? Dying is such a soulful experience. And I think that I also was trying to take some of the sting out of the way in which we regard death. We've seen death as the grim reaper, you know, the one who comes to take us, right, and steals us from our lives. And I think that actually it's a much gentler process than that. And there's even a kind of love that shows up in the time of dying that reminded me of a kind of maternal love.
You remind me of the line, "Oh, death, where is thy sting?" But also of a famous line from Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning, death is the mother of beauty. Because really the argument in your book is if you are mindful of death, and I use mindful in the real full sense of that word, it can make you live life more fully and more compassionately and more in the moment. Also, I was going back in my own mind to a time when I was about 14 years old. My father said to me, "Your grandfather's dying, and I want you to see him on his deathbed." And took me upstairs in the hospital. And my grandfather had gangrene, and he was barely breathing, and so forth. And my father said, "My father's a lot younger than I am now." He said, "I want you to realize how close life and death are, how they are the same, and you can't separate them. They're connected," which is really what you're saying in the opening of your book.
Yeah. So, how old were you? 14.
Yeah.
And what was it like then? What was the impact of doing that, having that time with your...
An enormous impact. I mean, it's lasted a lifetime, you know, to realize that there's a thin gossamer thread that separates the two. And I think what you're getting at here is something that... And I think I'm going to ask you if you see a cultural change, because mostly most of us have tried to keep death at bay, as you suggested, to not even let it entertain our thoughts. It's too forbidden and it's too scary, really.
Yeah.
And yet I think you're noticing, and from your work, you've noticed a change, a cultural change?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've seen a big change in the last several decades. I mean, you and I lived through the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco. There were 30,000 people who died of this epidemic just here in the Bay Area. So I think what's happened is that death has kind of come out of the closet, so to speak, and we have a lot more contact with it. There are many more books on the shelves these days. That's wonderful to see. Hospice care has become part of the continuum of healthcare, so that people are using this option much more often than they did in the past. But also, I think the generations that are coming up are really trying to understand what matters most. And one of the places they turn to understand that is to the experience that happens, to the experience of dying, to see when people are dying, what matters to them? What really matters, you know? And why wait until the time of our death to discover that truth?
Well, you can wake up fully to life when you face death head on, and there's a wisdom in the dying and the recognition of dying imparts, and you certainly communicate that. And you tell a lot of stories in your book, and you say all these stories come out of a kind of intimacy and trust in you being there with these people. Give me a sense of what might be a particularly useful parable for listeners in terms of a story that they can ingest, they can absorb, and they can find useful in their own life.
Well, I remember once being called to the hospice at 3 a.m. to visit with a patient. And I came into the room, and she was having a very difficult time breathing despite all the proper interventions we'd made, oxygen, morphine, etc. But there's a labor to dying, just like there's a labor to getting born. And I went into the room and I sat down in the corner. That's my way. And she was breathing with great difficulty. And there was a very well-meaning attendant, nurse's aide, next to her. And she turned to Adele and she said, "Adele, you don't have to be frightened. We're right here with you." And Adele, who was this rough, tough, 86-year-old Russian Jewish woman, turned to her and said, "Honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be frightened." So I stayed in the corner, yeah? After a little bit, the attendant said to her, "You look a little cold. Would you like a shawl or a blanket around you?" And Adele said, "Well, of course I'm cold. I'm almost dead." And I thought to myself, well, I hope I have half the tenacity of this woman when I'm dying. But I noticed two things when I was there, and maybe you can even notice them in the story. And that was that there was a struggle, there was a labor to dying, and it was manifesting in the breath. And the second was that Adele didn't want any nonsense. She didn't want to talk about tunnels of light, you know, or Bardo's or these things. She wanted honest, real connection. So I pulled my chair up as close to her as I am sitting next to you. And I said, Adele, would you like the struggle a little less? And she said, yeah. I said, okay, I noticed something. I noticed just there at the end of your exhale, there was this little gap, this little pause at the end of the exhale. I wonder what it would be like if you could just place your attention there just for a moment. Now, she doesn't care beans about Buddhism or meditation or any of these things, but she's highly motivated in this moment to be free of suffering. So I said, I'll do it with you. So together we did it, breathing together in and out. And I could watch as she settled into that little gap at the end of the exhale, how the fear just drained from her face, and she relaxed. And a few minutes later, she turned, said hello, said goodbye to me, laid back in her pillow and died. I think what Adele found was a place of rest in the middle of things. I think we're always imagining that our rest will come from managing the conditions or when we go on vacation or when we get our inbox empty, you know. I think we have to learn to find a place of rest right in the middle of our life. And we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is we're doing.
Including dying.
Including dying.
Yeah. In fact, you reminded me of another story in your book where you bring in the name of Ram Dass because there's a man who is dying and he's in terrible pain, almost, you know, ineffable pain, and you're trying to comfort him and doing things with your hand. And then suddenly it's as if he got sort of filled with a sense of love. He just began to repeat this thing about love.
Yeah. Yeah, Carl, he was kind of a grandfather figure to me. He used to wear a cardigan with leather buttons. I still have it, actually. I wear it around. And he wanted to use meditation to manage his pain. And, well, meditation is skillful, but it doesn't necessarily take away severe pain. And for that, you know, we need to use proper pain and symptom management. Anyway, we were trying to help him understand how he could make a little space around the pain. And so I put my hands on his belly and he said, oh, it hurts too much. And then I pulled my hands a little further away and I said, how's that? And he said, a little better. And I pulled my hands still further away and he said, oh, that's lovely. Now, I wasn't doing any California woo-woo stuff or energy work or any of this. What was happening was we were just finding space for the pain. And I said to him, could you rest there for a moment? And he said, yeah, rest in love. Rest in love. And this became his kind of mantra. Whenever he'd get in pain, he'd push his morphine pump. And then he'd say to himself, rest in love. Rest in love. So, yeah, I think that even in the midst of really challenging situations, we can find a kind of resourcefulness in ourselves.
What about that California woo-woo that you alluded to? Does that have a place in all of this?
Well, I don't know.
Because we are afraid of so many. I remember the Woody Allen line. I'm not afraid of death. I just want to be there when it happens. You know, yeah. It's kind of an attitude that a lot of people have.
I think we have to be really mindful about imposing our ideas on other people. You know, one of the things that was beautiful about the Zen Hospice Project is that we didn't try to push any dogma. We worked mostly with people who lived on the streets and park benches behind City Hall. They didn't care about Buddhism. They just wanted to be warm, dry, and inside, you know? And so if we were going to be of any value to them, we had to be really clear about our intention and not push any kinds of agendas on them, yeah?
And what about your own struggle? I mean, you had a heart attack, and that was a transformative experience?
Well, I used to think I knew a lot about dying until I had my own heart attack. I was teaching a workshop for docs and nurses on compassion, and in the middle of it, I had a heart attack. In fact, I was in a video conference with Ram Dass when it was happening. Yeah, it's a different view from the other side of the sheets, you know? One of the things that became really clear to me when I was recovering from my own heart attacks and in the hospital was that hospitals have protocols and procedures for everything. And sometimes those are great, and I wouldn't be here without those procedures. But sometimes they pull us out of the present moment. They're so future-oriented. You know, I'd be in my hospital room, and somebody would come in, and they'd say, how are you today? I'd say, miserable. I feel awful. And they'd say, well, it'll be better tomorrow. It'll be better tomorrow. But today it wasn't. And I just needed somebody to be with me today who was willing and able to be with the fact that I was miserable today. I think we're so busy trying to fix situations, sometimes we fail to appreciate the healing power of just human presence.
We're talking to Frank Ostrzeski, co-founder of Zen Hospice Project and founder of the Metta Institute. And his book is called The Five Invitations. We'll find out what those are. And the subtitle is Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. And he'll be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera on the 1st of April. And you can go to kqed.org/forum for a link to his other upcoming events. Let's talk about the whole idea of struggling against death. The great Welsh poet Dylan Thomas says, "Don't go gentle," and a lot of people, take that as great wisdom. You think one should go gently?
Well, I don't have an idea about how anybody should go. I think that
each has to go his or her own way.
Exactly. I mean, oftentimes when I was working at Zen Hospice, volunteers would come and say, "John's dying. What should we do?" And I said, "I don't know. Go ask John. John knows." And I'm not trying to be facetious here. I just mean that each death, like each birth, is completely unique. And we need to honor that process. And some people will blossom and make great reconciliations with their families. And others will turn toward the wall and withdraw, and they'll never come back again. Both of them taught me. Yeah. So I don't have an idea about how people should do it.
And you said you taught doctors compassion. How do you teach compassion?
I think really what we do is we evoke compassion, and partly we do that by looking at what the obstacles are that are in the way. What are the ideas that block the doorway to compassion, so to speak? That's what we have to really look at. Oftentimes, it's our knowing. It's our fixed belief systems, our opinions. They get in the way.
There's a line in your book where you say raising four teens sometimes is tougher than taking care of the dying. I know that was said somewhat tongue-in-cheek or facetiously, but teenagers can certainly be tough. And when your son, you write about your son Gabe's birth and the importance of mentors like Stephen Levine, but also Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was there with you, I believe, when your son was born. Is that
well,
right?
Elizabeth was an important mentor for me. And when my son was to be born, I had this feeling that my job was to help bring his soul into the world. And I thought, well, Elizabeth seems to be good at getting people's souls out. Maybe she can help me understand this. So I went to one of her workshops. And actually, she didn't help me very much with that. But what she did do was show me how it was possible to be with people in enormous pain, in enormous suffering, and regard them with love and stay in the room when the going got rough.
Isn't there a danger, though, in internalizing it? How do you keep that balance between absorbing it, taking it in, and feeling that kind of pain through compassion and empathy and keeping some sense of your own volition and distance?
I think empathy is a great doorway to compassion. It's one of the ways that compassion comes alive for us. But we can get empathetically overloaded. We can get so entangled in someone else's pain and suffering that we lose ourselves. That's like two depressed people down a well without a ladder. It's not very helpful. So if I'm going to be a compassionate presence, I've got to be able to stay over here in my own seat. I've got to be over here so that I have access to my skills and my stability, et cetera, so that I can be of some value to this person. You know, when Elizabeth taught me this, one day I was coming out of one of her workshops and I had been sitting in the back of the room watching and observing all this pain, and I was doing exactly what you were saying. I was getting merged with all this pain in a way that wasn't so helpful. And I came out of the workshop, and I just fell down on my knees and started crying. And Elizabeth came along with her cigarette and her cup of coffee, and she pulled me up, and she said, "All you were trying to take on their pain. You can't take on their pain. You got to let it move through you." And that was a really great teaching for me, and it really supported me throughout the last 25, 30 years of working with folks at the end of life.
What about her? At the end, as she got toward the end of life, she really started believing in spooks and ghosts and all sorts of poltergeist-type things.
She had a whole belief system around what happens after we die and angels and various kinds of guides that would help her through this process. That's her way. That was Elizabeth's way, And there's no one way. Look, I was working with a woman who was a Christian Scientist. Great, beautiful woman. Just feeling like she was coming close to the end of her life, and she just wanted to lay down in the lap of Jesus, And her daughter came to visit her, granddaughter rather, came to visit her. And she said, Grandma, she said, you don't have to worry. When you die, everybody who's died before you will be there to meet you. And so you don't have to worry about it at all. Well, Grandma became terrified. Because what she hadn't shared with her family was that her husband, Edgar, had been beating her most of her life. And he had died 5 years before. And now the idea of spending eternity with Edgar was terrifying to her. So when she shared this with me, we kind of worked our way through
this.
Said
Edward was probably in a darker, more fiery place where he belonged.
I don't know quite how they set up that hotel there.
Yeah, right. You get into a word that has been important to me in many ways, and it has to do with maybe the preciousness of life. We could get into a whole discourse about that because there are a lot, you know, I keep thinking about Hobbes, life is nasty, brutish, and short, you know, as opposed to precious. But there's a sense of savoring life, especially savoring. It's an important word, you know, being within the moment, in the here and now, and savoring especially what is precious or what is good.
Sure. I mean, think about the things that we enjoy in life, a good cup of tea, right? A wonderful meal. The holding each other. These are all activities that we savor. We really want to soak in them, so to speak, you know.
And death can make that more full, but at the same time, it can also draw you into its clutches sometimes and make you think darker thoughts, can't you?
It certainly can, but I don't think of death as the enemy. I don't think death is something that's trying to capture us in some way. I think it's a natural part of our lives. And absolutely, we can become frightened about the experience. And in such cases, we need compassionate support. We need people to be with us who aren't afraid of our fear.
And that has to do with grief, too, for loss of loved ones through death, same principle?
Well, I was just listening to your segment before this one on the Oakland Raiders. And, the various faces of grief that are apparent in that are remarkable. Anger, sadness, disbelief, denial, all those are part of the experience of grieving. And I think that, again, what's most helpful here is to be able to be a quiet, listening presence. You know, listening, as you do so well, is the shortest distance between two people.
We're talking with Frank Ostasevsky, and let's talk with you and hear your thoughts about this. And please feel free to join the conversation. We will get to those five invitations as well. I promise, that's the subtitle of the book, is Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully, but the title is The Five Invitations. And here's an invitation to you to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Thoughts? Questions, comments, reflections. We welcome your involvement. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. You're listening again to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Frank Ostasevsky, who is co-founder of Zen Hospice Project and also founder of the Meta Institute. And his most recent book is The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. He'll be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera on April 1st. Sounds funny about April 1st. There's no fooling around here. We're talking about the ultimate subject. And you can go to kqed.org/forum for a link to his other upcoming events. But in the meantime, you are welcome to join this conversation with any thoughts or reflections that you might have or simply stories that you may indeed want to share with us. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. So, Frank, I promised the five invitations. Let's just start with the first one. Don't wait.
Don't wait. I mean, you know, waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. I can't tell you how many times, Michael, I've been with a family who've said to me, you know, when is Mom going to die? And waiting for the moment of dying, they miss all the moments in between. So to don't wait isn't to get caught up in a certain kind of urgency around life. It is to really recognize the ephemeral nature of this life, though. I think when we recognize how precarious our life actually is, it introduces us to just how precious it is. Then we don't want to waste a moment. Then we want to jump into our life with both feet. We want to tell the people we love that we love them, you know?
Instead of wasting time because you don't have the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's what becomes evident when you're with people who are dying, is every breath counts. Every moment counts. Why wait until then to live that way?
Let me just go through these, and then we'll go to calls and emails. Don't wait is the first. The second is welcome everything. Push away nothing. That's pretty absolute.
Yeah, it would make a great bumper sticker, huh? So welcome everything, push away nothing. It sort of confronts us with our normal judgments to welcome everything. Well, do we know what it is that's going to wake us up? Do we know what it is that's going to really deliver us into clarity in our lives? Hard to say. I think that it's not encouragement to be a doormat. I think it's when we welcome things, we're willing to meet them. I mean, what did Baldwin have to say? He said, not everything that we face can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless we're willing to face it.
You also, this is not one of the invitations, but you say embrace uncertainty. And that's, I think, an important piece of wisdom in what you've outlined here is these five invitations. The third is bring your whole self to the experience. The self can be very divided, as we learned from R.D. Lang and many others. Yeah. The self can be very fragmented and so forth. What do you mean by the whole self? The whole self in the moment?
I mean the whole of who I am, you know. Oftentimes, for example, working with folks who are dying, I have found that the parts of myself that I most wanted to hide away, the parts of myself that I was ashamed of even, became an extraordinary meeting place with the people who I was working with. They, too, were experiencing shame and difficulties or had hidden parts of themselves that they hadn't revealed. So to bring our whole self means to bring every aspect of ourself forward, not just our strength and expertise, but also our helplessness and our fear. They're meeting places with other people. I think that if we...
Let me just dwell with that for a moment with you, because a lot of times I think, and I've had experience with family and friends dying, and a lot of times you realize, at least I did, that they were caught between wanting to succumb to that feeling of helplessness and wanting to show courage and wanting to essentially be strong. I mean, often for their loved ones, to show them, you know, that they have a certain grace with dying. It could go sometimes either way, you know, within the moment.
Sure, and it will go either way, inevitably. I mean, in other words, there isn't going to be one way in which this happens. But, my own sense is that if I'm willing to bring everything I have forward, there's many more options for meeting this other person, you know, than if I'm only coming forward with my strength. To be whole means to invite it all in. You know, every part of herself. It doesn't mean to be perfect. It means no part left out.
Two more, and then we'll go to your calls and emails. Number four is find a place of rest in the middle of things.
Yeah, we were talking about that a little while ago when we were talking about Adele. You know, to really draw our attention right down to what we're doing right now. There's an old Zen story about this, about a monk who's sweeping the temple grounds, and another one walks by and sort of wryly says, too busy, way too busy. And the monk says, well, you should know that there's one who's not busy. And he was talking about that inner calm, that inner stability that we can have, even when we're in the midst of a lot of activity.
Also suggests, you know, the importance of finding just a place where you can, a serene place or a place of peace or a place of quietude or something along those lines.
Sure, sure.
Cultivate don't know mind. That's number five.
Yeah, I felt obliged to put something Zen-like in the list, you know. The cultivate don't know mind isn't an encouragement to be ignorant. Or to throw away our knowing. It's a mind that's open and receptive, full of wonder. It can walk in the room not so full of our knowing, but rather with some degree of receptivity. It's the beginner's mind, the Suzuki Roshi spoke about so often.
Well, I asked you about why you chose she for death, and here's Jean who writes, I read your book and I took offense to your reference to death as she. Since when is death female? Why should death be anthropomorphic anyways?
Well, I think that someone else could take the opposite view, necessarily. We've tended to see death as a he. It was just a way I had of speaking about death.
Do you speak of God as a she, or do you speak of God at all?
I think that, as maybe the caller or the writer is suggesting, God is neither of these and all of these.
Let me go to our callers, and we begin, Amy, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to share a story with you that you reminded me of when you were talking about Adele. When my mother was dying, I had the privilege of being with her when she was dying. And she had been kind of choking and gasping and was panicking. You could see it in her face. And I had had some biofeedback training and knew how to do visualization stuff. So I said, Mom, I'm going to try and help you relax. You need to stop panicking. And I knew she loved to snorkel. So I said, imagine you're snorkeling. And then I did a whole visualization of her snorkeling and seeing the fish and reaching out to touch the fish and all this stuff. And her breathing started calming down and calming down. And she closed her eyes and slipped into her coma and died.
You know, I'm very touched by that story because it shows the power of imagination too, doesn't it, Frank?
Yeah, and I think also the power of the caller's presence with her mother. I suspect that her loving care was as important as the visualizations and the imagination that was being
engaged.
Exactly
my thought, the tenderness of it all. Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Amy. And on we go to another caller. Let me bring Madeline in next. Madeline, welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Having also worked as a hospice nurse and on a personal basis been a hospice nurse for my father, I have come to experience the difficulties in having a platform or discussion with regard to my own family members, especially my aging mother. I have been seeking a means of trying to figure out a process of how to do that, because I can do that with patients and people I've cared for, yet unable to bridge that gap with my mother. I'm hoping Frank may have something to provide for me at this moment.
Well, I tend not to hit people over the head with death. I try and come toward it in a way that's helpful. For example, I ask people, well, what matters most to you? What's really important in this life to you? And then we're in a different discussion, you see. I had a guy I worked with who was a 30-year heroin user. Jackie was his name. And he was at the Zen Hospice. I said, Jackie, here you are at the Zen Hospice. I said, do you think you might get born again? He said, yeah. I said, well, what are you going to come back as? I said, you could come back as a cow, you know. He said, no, I'm not coming back as no goddamn cow. He said, I'm coming back as Jackie. I said, why do you want to be Jackie? I said, you could be a king or a queen. He said, no, he said, I'm coming back as Jackie because next time I want to get it right. And you see, we were into a really different discussion now. We were into a discussion about his death. If I'd came to him and said, what are the five things you really want around your dying, Jackie wouldn't have responded. So speaking to this caller, I think talk to your mom about what matters most to her. What does she feel like this life has been about for her? What does she... when her life has come to an end, what does she want to be able to say about this life? What's the legacy of this life? I think those are the kinds of questions that can lead us into those discussions.
Another thought, though, from what Madeline has brought up, that is somebody who's doing this kind of hospice work who then can't necessarily translate it. It's like, I know doctors who will not treat their own family members. Yeah. There seems to be a kind of an impediment sometimes. Right?
Well, I think that's often the case that, we can have very intimate conversations with people that we don't know because there's less complexity in those relationships than there are with our own parents, for example. I'd also like to refer you to the Conversation Project, which is a really great program that has all kinds of tools and aids in helping people to have these kinds of conversations with their family and friends.
So here's John who writes, I lost my mom last September and was with her over that time period, but not at the moment when she passed. It was almost 1 a.m. and I was doing a mindfulness meditation and had the strongest premonition that she had gone. She was talking to me in my head saying that she had left and was exceedingly happy and joyful. Has anyone else reported these sorts of premonitions? Is it something that's not something I talk about? Because, again, it sounds probably woo-woo, and yet you've heard stories like this, haven't you?
Oh, lots of them, Michael, lots of them. And And I neither try and confirm or deny them, I just try and see what's the meaning and value of it for the particular person who's telling the story. It's not uncommon that we want to be with people at the time of their dying, and sometimes we feel tremendous guilt that we weren't there with them. And what I want to remind people of is that we had a whole lifetime with them, And It's not that final moment that matters so much. It's what happened prior to that. So let's let death be our advisor in that way and remind us to tell the people we love that we love them.
It's interesting, though, again, when you talk about death as our advisor, and I'm thinking about death be not proud. And we do anthropomorphize death. We make
sure
it
we
into—
Every culture has.
Just about every culture, you're right, yeah.
Why
do you suppose that is? Why not see it as some kind of force beyond our pale, like God, for example?
Or— well, think about the Greek gods, you know, think about the Hindu gods. These are all, we could, in one way, we could think about them as metaphors for the various powers and forces that exist in each of us as human beings, you know. And
you
death
think
is,
of death as a metaphor, really.
Well, death is the, absolutely. I mean, it's not happening at the end of a long road. It's right here, right now.
It's the metaphor of metaphors in many ways. And let me get another caller on. Marcy joining us. Marcy, hi.
Hi, good morning. I've been a hospice volunteer for over 30 years and both learned and experienced everything that has been discussed today. It has led me to be the most grounded of all my life experiences. It has Being with people who are dying has opened my heart more than any of my other life experiences, and it is the most beautiful transactions I have ever experienced.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And these are things that people frequently do say about the intensity and the uplifting nature, often use the word spiritual. I'm looking at a comment from Bill, who writes about the Zen Hospice Center. He said, they helped my friend Stephen die back in 1994. It was that wonderful small hospice on Cole Street. His guide taught me to match his breathing as he was dying, and he would know what to do. I felt that I walked him to the gate and let him go. It was a wonderful experience that stayed with me when I sat with my mom during her last days. And I know what to do and not to do. It was a highlight of my life.
You know, Michael, I'm not romantic about dying. I think it's the hardest work we may ever do in our lives. You know, it can be beautiful and it can be messy and it can be, you know, transformational. But most of all, it's ordinary. All of us are going to go through this. Nobody gets out of here alive, right? And so I think that if we can start encouraging each other to go toward this experience instead of running in the other direction, we might start to learn about what are the lessons it has to teach, and you know, what's the, how can it inform us in living a more meaningful and rich life?
It's ordinary, but it's hard, as you said, and it's the hardness I think that that bears down on people and makes them, in many ways, chained in terms of what chained from what you're presenting here, which is a desire to be free, really, to be more loose and to be
absolutely
at ease, really.
You know, I told you at the beginning of our interview that I worked on the streets of San Francisco with folks who were homeless, you know, who were really on the margins of society. And they were, when they started facing their dying, it felt unimaginable to them and unbearable. And they couldn't imagine how they could possibly get through it. And yet, oftentimes, these people found a resourcefulness in themselves, a capacity that they didn't know they had. And that came forward in the time of dying.
Doesn't have to be faith either, does it?
It's not faith, not necessarily faith at all. In fact, sometimes people's religious beliefs are a challenge for them. They hold them back. I believed that I've all my life I prayed and God would be good to me, and now I'm dying, and what did I do wrong? You know, that's a misunderstanding of faith, I think.
What about suicide? Where does that fit into this picture for you?
Well, I think if we're going to work with somebody who's contemplating suicide, it has to be okay with you that. And you have to understand the pain that they might be in. Now, of course, we have physician-assisted death, which is an entirely different topic than suicide. And what we're finding in that is that when people have this option, when they know that this is a possibility for them, they start relaxing a little bit. And oftentimes, they don't choose that particular course of action. But knowing that it's an option for them really helps them enormously.
Just knowing it's there, the hemlock is there if they want it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we look at what's happened in Oregon and Washington, for example, states of Oregon and Washington, many, many people seek out information about physician-assisted death. But last year, I think it was under 100 people in the state of Oregon who actually completed the process that way.
We're talking with Frank Ostoseski, and his book is called The Five Invitations. Here's a listener who tweets, how does this translate to the grief and isolation felt by those surviving a loved one's passing, for those stuck in grief?
Well, you know, in my experience, grief is... There's no one way through grief, right? There's only our way. And we have a lot of models out there about how people should grieve and when they should be over it and such things. And I tend not to follow those too much. I think that there is enormous pain in the loss of someone we love. And that pain can show up as sadness, or it can show up as anger, or it can show up as numbness. There's many faces to grief, you know. And our work and the work of supporting someone in grief is to meet them all, to go toward every single one of those expressions of grief. And in a way, we could say metabolize them, include them in our lives. When someone we love dies, we don't just lose that person. We lose the role they play in our lives. And so when we climb into bed at night where our wife used to sleep next to us, the bed feels cold and we lose her again. You know?
Well, here's a kind of added thought along those lines, but it's in a question again. Michelle asks, do you have any words of solace or advice for those of us who have lost a loved one suddenly and unexpectedly, in this case with none of her loved ones around? We've been left with profound feelings of bereftness and regret, and it has been difficult for me to move forward.
Yeah. Well, I think what can be really helpful in a situation like this is talking to others who have been through a similar circumstance. People who can earn your trust because they know something about what you're experiencing. It's really difficult to lose anyone to death, even through a long-term illness. But sudden death can be particularly difficult. We don't have any warning. We get taken by surprise.
I'm actually looking at the back of your book with praise from a lot of illustrious people, including our colleague Bill Moyers, and actually he found out about his mother's death in the middle of an interview with you. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Bill and I knew each other from some other circumstances, but he was at the San Francisco Zen Center interviewing me for his documentary On Our Own Terms. And we took a break in the interview, and I said, "Hey, Bill, how's your mom?" And he said that she was in a hospice at that point in New Jersey, and she was coming closer to the end of her life. And we talked a lot about it, and then the phone rang, and he got the message that his mother had died. And I remember his staff wanted to continue filming, and I said, you know, Bill's a very private person. And so we went into his room together quietly and spent a little time together. And I was very honored and grateful that he was willing to share with me that experience.
There's William, who writes, "When I was a very young man, my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. We made a pact that he was going to fight to be alive and achieve an acceptable quality of life. Months later, he told me that about how hard he was fighting, yet the quality of life was unacceptable. So I offered an idea: stop fighting and see what happens. He was phenomenally well for the next week before he passed. It was quite remarkable to me and completely unexpected."
Yeah.
And another listener says, "When my mother passed, the members of our church members came over and quietly told my mother about all the things that she had done for them, and then began to sing her favorite songs. They did for her what we could not do, and I'm so happy that she passed listening to the sounds of things that she loved."
Aren't these beautiful rituals, Michael? Isn't that wonderful to read about that? That this is happening all the time, everywhere? And so I no longer think of us as being a death-denying culture. I think people are moving toward this experience, and I think they're hungry to talk about it, and that's why I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation today.
Do you believe that there is such a thing as... I used to actually honestly kind of almost reflexively recoil when I heard people speaking about a good death, because I thought, you know, maybe some deaths are good, but most of them are bad for those who have to suffer in the wake of loss and grieving and the things we've been talking about.
I'm a little troubled by the term, to be honest. And what bothers me about it is I think we might be setting a standard about how people are supposed to die. This is a good death, then that means the other one isn't a good death. Death is hard. It's hard work, you know. And it's hard for the person that's going through the process, and it's hard for his or her family as well. So, yes, I think that people can make remarkable transformations in the time of dying. However, I'm reticent to set some kind of standard about how it's supposed to look.
Do you ever have an opinion one way or another about Dr. Kevorkian, who was known as Dr. Death, in fact?
Well, you know, Dr. Kevorkian, when I was coming up in hospice care, Dr. Kevorkian was quite a force. I think that we have much better options these days than Dr. Kevorkian, and there was an awful lot of manipulation in what he did.
Here's Sandy as our next caller. Sandy, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Andy. Thank you so much for the call and for the taking my call. My father just passed away 4 days ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. And but it was a beautiful process, and he suffered from pancreatic cancer, and the last few weeks was just excruciating pain. And he had prepared his death. He had prepared for it, and he prepared to end his life. And he knew that he waited for me to come back from a trip in Asia. And once I was there with my brothers and his twin brother and my mother, it was time for him. And he basically wanted to take his own life. He knew what the dignity was that he wanted, and he knew sort of the line between life and death for himself. And he did that. But I'll tell you that the process, the sort of secretiveness of what he was going to take and how he was going to do it, and it was difficult. And I was wondering if you had some perspective about that and how people do this with dignity, but do it on their own terms. And we had a beautiful experience, but I felt like it was somewhat secretive in how he went about it.
Well, Andy, thank you, first of all, for your willingness to share that. And just tell me your dad's first name.
Don.
Don. Well, thank you for bringing him here, too, and appreciate that you're honoring him in that way. You know, death is hard enough, right, without creating a lot of secrets around it. I can only point to the experience that's happening in other states, in Washington and Oregon, and now, of course, it's now law in California, and this kind of secretiveness that has so characterized this kind of physician-assisted death is now can be lifted. And I think this is a great, great boon for people. Now, I'm not advocating physician-assisted death. That's not my position. But I am suggesting that people should be able to make their own choices.
Again, sorry for your loss, Sandy. Thank you for the call. I guess it's an individual decision about the quality of life when the quality of life is no longer applicable or it just doesn't hold up anymore.
Yeah, but Michael, I think this is a decision we can't make way in the future. You know, what is quality of life for us now might be quite different for us in the final week of our life. There was a guy I worked with who tried to take his life and wound up in a psychiatric unit at San Francisco General. We admitted him to Zen Hospice, and he kept wanting to explore this, you know, possibility of taking his life. And at the time, there was a book by Derek Humphreys that explained how to do this when you have terminal illness, and I got it for him, and I read it to him. Now, in the end, he didn't make this choice, partly because he was surrounded by so much love and support at the hospice. In fact, he said to me, "Frank, I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life." And I said, "How is that possible?" I said, "Just a few weeks ago, you wanted to kill yourself because you couldn't walk in the woods or write in your diaries." He said, "Oh, that was just chasing desire," he said to me. I said, "What do you mean? Are these things not important anymore?" He said, "No." He said, "Now my pleasure comes from the coolness of the breeze and the softness of the sheets." I thought this was a remarkable turnaround for a guy I met in the psychiatric unit at San Francisco General. In other words, what we find in our lives is what determines its value and purpose for us. Its dignity is not found necessarily in what we imagined, where we imagined we would find it.
Or desired. That sounds very Zen to me. And let me get another caller on. Tina joins us from Sacramento. Tina, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Michael. What a wonderful show. I've had the privilege of sitting by the bedside of a number of people as they make their transition, and certainly the hardest one was being with my own mom. And one of the things that I did in the last days leading up to her her actual death was to just sit in the room with her, and I wrote haiku as a way to make sure that I stayed present to what was happening and what was going on. And I just was looking back at those as I listened to the conversation, and it brings it all back. It is such an amazing time. But what really struck me during that time with my mother was that the mothers work really hard, labor really hard to to birth the body into this life, the body that, depending on your tradition, but for me, holds the soul, the eternal soul. And the mother works so hard to birth that body. And then at the other end of life, the body works equally hard to birth the soul into whatever it is that comes next. Oh. And it just, it helped me reframe that whole picture of death, because it's as sacred and in many ways as joyful as birth, but because we've hidden it away and made it somehow not part of life, people have this fear and resistance to it, where if you enter into that space, you receive so many gifts back.
Well, Tina, I thank you for that call. It reminds me of a dear friend of mine who, in dying, was more joyful than I'd ever seen him. His family, his loved ones were around him. He was a man who we used to joke about. He carried suffering on his shoulders throughout his life, but he had a fairly joyful sense, and he knew he was going out. Frank, it's been a great pleasure and an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Macklin. Thanks for sharing these stories and helping us to reframe the way in which we view death.
And again, Frank Ostasevsky's book is The Five Invitations. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.